Committee on Rules. We have a couple of House members here to testify. Since we don't have a quorum, we will be officially in subcommittee, but I would like to get the House members on so that they can go to their first session. Ms. Harris, 8C or 10, why don't you tell us a little bit about the resolution, and Representative Hannah, why don't you come forward?
Thank you, Madam Chair. HCR 10 honors the life, public service, and philanthropy of former State Representative Stubb Stewart.
Okay. Welcome. Good afternoon.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, I'm State Representative Bruce Hanna, representing House District 7. HCR 10 is the Stubb Stewart Memorial. This concurrent resolution is meant to honor an Oregon icon, Lauren LaSalle Stubb Stewart. Stubb was one of Oregon's most dedicated and distinguished citizens. I will tell you, Stubb comes from his stature, so he went by Stubb frequently. He was born in Cottage Grove and graduated from Cottage Grove High School. He earned a degree in logging engineering from Oregon Agricultural College, or now OSU. Mm. During World War II, he served our country in the U.S. Army, reaching the rank of lieutenant colonel, and was awarded the Grand Star of China and the Bronze Star. Stubb returned to Oregon and built Bohemia Lumber Company. Bohemia had more than 2,000 employees, with mills in Coburg, Culp Creek, Drain, Eugene, Gardner, Saginaw, Vaughan, and in California. At one time, Bohemia Lumber was the nation's largest producer of laminated beams. But Stubb was not just a timber baron. He was always determined to build more than a great business. He wanted to build a great state. Stubb has been described as one of the Northwest's most colorful and most powerful lumbermen. Yet one of the gifts he left Oregon is the Oregon Beach Bill, which made the dry sands of Oregon beaches public domain. In 1988, Stewart himself named his top three achievements: 23 years as chair of the State Parks and Rec Advisory Board, when in fact Stubb ended up serving over 40 years on that board; his leadership role in passing conservation laws; and his advocacy of research and education. During his many years on the Park and Rec Advisory Board, he was most proud of the long list of parks created during his tenure. We were provided a list of over 100 parks and recreation areas that were established during Stubb's tenure on the board. In the House committee hearing for this bill, many interesting facts and observations on Stubb's life came about. When you travel through what is now known as the Clear Lake Cutoff, or Highway 126, understand that Stubb Stewart actually walked that path, choosing and surveying the route the highway would eventually take. Of his knowledge of the forests, it was once said that Stubb Stewart knew every tree by its first name. During his busy career, Stubb also spent three terms as a member of the Oregon House of Representatives, serving in 1951, 53, and the 55 sessions. In addition, he served on and contributed to the following business boards: Associated Oregon Industries, president and co-founder; chairman of the Portland branch of the Federal Reserve Bank of San Francisco; chairman and founder, Oregon Forest Industry Council; director, president, and chairman of the National Forest Products Association; president of the Timber Operators Council; committee member of the Governor's Labor Management Relations Committee; member of the Lumber Subcouncil of National Industrial Pollution Control. Stubb's support for education and community service included serving as a committee member of Colleges for Oregon's Future, trustee for the Eugene Performing Arts Council, director of the Eugene Bethel Education Foundation, trustee of Linfield College, and many, many more. And so many that I will just stop short on that list, but it is a long list of contributions. Truly, Stubb's activities are too numerous to mention. His generous contribution to Oregon education were recognized not just at Oregon State, where he graduated, which honored Stewart with the university's Distinguished Service Award in 1978, but also the University of Oregon, which gave Stewart its Pioneer Award the very next year. No one else had ever won the top public service honors at both universities. As an example of the broad respect for Stubb's years of service, this bill was sponsored by Republicans and Democrats alike, the entire Lane and Douglas County delegations. In his State of the State address, Governor Ted Kulongoski said Stewart's life represented Winston Churchill's observation: "We make a living by what we get, but we make a life by what we give." When I first considered this project, I questioned if this was a good use of our time here. The answer was a resounding yes. As a leader in industry, philanthropy, and public service, we do need to hold Stubbs Stewart up as an example not only for our children, but for all Oregonians. HCR 10 passed the House on a unanimous vote. Stubb truly was an Oregon icon, and with that, colleagues, I'd urge your support for HCR 10, the Stubbs Stewart Memorial.
Thank you very much. I'll assume there's no questions for you, Representative Hanna. I appreciate you coming today, and as soon as we get a quorum, I anticipate we'll move this. Senator Farioli can't be here today, but he had asked to carry it on the Senate floor. So.
Thank you very much.
No, maybe that was Senator Sansky. I'm getting confused, but we'll make sure that somebody carries that's appropriate. So.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. Anybody else wishing to testify on HCR 10? Okay, we're going to close the public hearing on HCR 10. Open the public hearing on HJM 6. Representative Nelson, why don't you come forward? Ms. Harris, why don't you tell us a little bit about the bill? And we are still officially in subcommittee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Committee, HJM 6 urges Congress to amend the Internal Revenue Code to allow military veterans who served after December 31, 1976 to participate in Oregon's Home Loans for Veterans program.
Thank you. Representative Nelson, do you mind if Mr. Willis comes up with you?
I would be honored.
Okay. Why don't you go ahead and get started, and Mr. Willis will make his way up.
Thank you. Chair Brown, Senator Shields, and Tiffany, thank you so much for hearing this bill today. This is a very important bill. We have been committed in the House Committee on Veterans Affairs to do what Director Willis says so well, is to be sure in Oregon that Veterans Day is every day. And we felt it's our responsibility, since these brave men and women have secured our future and continue to do so at the risk of their own lives, their families, and their future, that we do everything we can to secure their lives the best we can and their future. Therefore, we're here to support House Joint Memorial 6. And I will be happy to, thought I had it with me, but I will, as soon as I get back to my office, bring you back exactly a copy of what I'm going to say today so that you have it for your files. But basically, the intent of House Joint Memorial 6 is to amend the specified section of the Internal Revenue Code to allow military veterans who served after December 31st, 1976 to participate in Oregon's Home Loan Program for veterans. And this is very important, as we have hundreds of young Oregonians who have served in Operation Iraqi Freedom in Afghanistan or in other nations in the Middle East, as well as in combat in other areas of the world, including Lebanon, Grenada, the Persian Gulf, Somalia, Haiti, Panama, Bosnia, Afghanistan, and more. And it's very important that we support these individuals. We have lost, as you know, many in this service, so we understand the risk. Currently, there are only four states, and I'm so proud that we are one of them, besides us, California, Texas, Alaska, and Wisconsin, with veteran home loan programs similar to ours. So this is one thing that I'm proud that we're in the top five. All five of these programs have been diminished due to a change made in 1984. That happened to the United States Internal Revenue Code. And what it did, this change, it made low-cost home loans obtained from qualified veterans' mortgage bonds available only to veterans having served on active military duty prior to 1977. So that seems very strange to me. Perhaps it was done with good hope that we would never have to see combat again. But unfortunately, that's not the way our world turns. But for over 50 years, Oregonians have chosen to honor and reward Oregon's veterans by authorizing the state to issue federal, state, tax-exempt bonds to be used for veterans' home loans. To date, over 330,000 home loans have been made to Oregon's veterans in recognition of their valued service and to help them in their transition back to civilian life. As I have been told by one of our military, there's nothing like having a home to return home to. Unfortunately, the federal tax law that was changed in 1984 caused low-cost monies to not be available to these veterans having served in active duty after 77. This inequitable federal restriction effectively created two separate classes of veterans. And I think that in itself is repulsive. We don't need classes of veterans. Those entering active duty prior to 1977, so we call those the pre-77 veterans, and those entering active service after 1976, we call those the post-76 veterans, like they aren't all fighting for their lives and ours. And it's a wrong. This segregation of veteran service periods in federal law has severely limited Oregon's ability to continue providing a housing benefit for the post-76 veterans. Without an imminent change in federal law, and it's bad enough if you read the press release today to see that the federal government has really acted distastefully, wrongly in our health benefits for veterans in funding them. That needs an imminent change also. We certainly want this housing benefit to not disappear in one more year by the end of 2006. So these men and women deserve our help. I hope you'll support us. The good director, Willis, has provided this service here and done so very well. We now have, as you know, 370,000 veterans in our state. We gave them $1 in the last legislature to help them open a wing in the Dalles. In fact, we forgot to fund the dollar. Representative Boquist paid it when we started our committee this year. We've done so little. So I know much more should be done. I appreciate your support.
Thank you. Representative Nelson, before you have to dash off, with you and Senator Shields here, I just wanted to have a conversation about I think it's fair to say that in terms of bipartisanship, this is one issue that we can agree, and I wonder if the two of you have discussed taking a delegation back to why are you looking at Washington, D.C. to lobby our congressional delegation along with our sister states?
Well, you know, I think I talked to already Senator Shields. So we're going to take a bus from every state of the union and a boat from, you know, that those Hawaiians over there. But we need to go back. And, I mean, every state needs, and you've heard me say this many times, Director Willis, it's time that we made our voices heard on behalf of those who've done so much and we've done so little for them. So I'm ready to go. I think we'll design the bus and hit the road, Jack.
What do you think?
Hit the road, Frank. Okay.
Like I said, I'd love to do it.
He's got
to
get well.
Hard part.
Well, of course, we do have to sign a die, but we're working on that on a daily basis. So.
We do have $50,000, I think, appropriated for this in our budget. To go back and lobby as long as necessary, but certainly want Senator Shields to get well first so he can drive that bus.
I think his wife might have some other plans for him, with all due respect, Representative Nelson. Okay, Mr. Willis, what else do you have to add?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Administrator Tiffany, good afternoon. I would simply like to say that I am more encouraged, perhaps, than the good representative's testimony may have indicated. I believe this body will, by the end of this session, make more strides toward assisting the veterans of this state than have been made since the end of World War II. Uh-huh. I'm very sincere about that. When these people came home and are coming home from the Middle East, they want education or vocational training. They need to have transportation and licensing for their vocation, and they need to have health care. But number one, they need a home. And we would love to be able to continue to offer these low-interest home loans to our Oregon veterans of all wars and all eras. Right now, our home loan is at 4.99%. It's well below market. It's a good deal. This body has already passed, and the governor's already signed a 100% loan. As a matter of fact, I believe it was the first bill to come out of the body. And that sends a message to these new veterans, as well as the veterans of other eras. To tell the committee where this bill is at the federal level, I expect that Representative Ryan from Wisconsin will drop the bill on the House side, and I believe they're looking at Memorial Day as being a good, appropriate day to drop such a bill. The companion bill on the Senate side will be dropped by our own Senator Gordon Smith. The entire Oregon delegation has indicated to me as short as 3 weeks ago in person that they will all support this once again. Not having said that, and notwithstanding that, this bus trip would still be a great idea in support of this. So I appreciate very much your willingness to allow me to testify on this memorial, and I urge its adoption by this body. Thank you, Chair.
Appreciate your joining us very much. We're going to let you go. And
so very much for you.
Assuming we have the votes on committee, we're going to go ahead and move it. All right.
Thank you.
Anybody else wishing to testify on HGM 6? Okay. With that, we're going to close the public hearing, which became a full public hearing because Sarah Atkinson joined us. Open a work session on HGM 6.
Move the bill.
Senator Atkinson.
Move the bill to the floor.
Senator Atkinson, would we move HGM 6 to the Senate floor with a due pass? Do approve recommendation?
Do adopt.
Recommendation. Any discussion? Any objection? Hearing and seeing none, so ordered. Senator Atkinson, do you want to carry this or do you want to give it to Senator Shields?
Sure.
Okay.
The bus driver. Sorry, I'll do it.
All right. Well, we look forward to your historical knowledge as we take the bus from Portland to Washington, D.C.
It'll be a ride.
Yeah, that's an understatement. Okay.
A tired joke if I ever heard one.
Okay, all right. We're going to open a public hearing on HJR 50. Ms. Harris, why don't you tell us a little bit about the bill, and we'll get a witness list.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. HJR 50 declares the year 2005 as Oregon PTA year.
Hi, Ms. Jordan. Welcome to your Senate Rules Committee. Feel free to go ahead and get started.
For the record, my name is Andy Jordan. I'm the Vice President for Legislation with for the Oregon PTA. Madam Chair, members of the committee, I am here today representing the 23,000 members of the largest child advocacy organization in the state. We are a 501c3 nonprofit. We have 240 local units across the state. We are in the metropolitan area and in rural areas. Our PTA members volunteer their time and talents, providing programs to supplement their school communities. We have a rich history that supports such radical ideas as kindergarten, school lunch,
For all children, right? For all children, and
vaccinations. And actually, if you go back in our history, the PTA volunteers were the one who actually administered the vaccinations. In our more recent history, in 1999, Oregon PTA was instrumental in working with Oregon Senator Hatfield for the adoption of the Parent Act, which is now was inserted into the Elementary and Secondary Education Act, now is still a part of No Child Left Behind, which acknowledged the important role of parent and community involvement as an integral part of student success. Today, 98% of our money goes directly back into our local communities and schools. At the statewide level, we are working to bridge the urban-rural divide with a new program called Taking Action Together, where we're actually partnering schools that are geographically diverse to try to find out what we have in common and how we support schools. Nationally, we join 6 million members in supporting public education. So on behalf of our members, we thank you for the nod to our past history and to our future.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Questions? Sarah Atkinson.
Polio?
Yes.
Was PTA active in?
Yes.
Was that the first vaccination push?
I believe so. It would be back in
early 50s.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah?
Yes, I believe so.
But That's all my only
question. Before I was
born. And I will check into that and make sure and get back to you.
Would you?
Yes, I will.
Thanks.
All right. Any other questions? Thank you, Ms. Jordan. We would move into work session on HJR 50. Chair would move HJR 50 to the Senate floor with a do adopt recommendation. Any discussion? Any objection? Hearing and seeing none, so ordered. Senator Shields, how do you feel about the PTA? Think you can handle this one on the Senate floor?
I'll try.
He'll try. Okay. Thank you very much. 10:54, we're going to step that over. We've got some amendments. Next up, last up, is Senate Bill 164. Anybody wishing to testify on Senate Bill 164 that has not testified before? I'm sorry. Thank you. Yes. I'm just closing. We're open a work session on HCR 10. The chair would move HCR 10, which is a memorial to the former state representative Stubbs Stewart, to the Senate floor with a do adopt recommendation. Any discussion? Any objection? Hearing and seeing none, so ordered. I will ask Senator Brzezinski to carry, and if he's unable to do so, Senator Farioli can carry that memorial. Okay, back on public hearing and possible work session on Senate Bill 164. Ms. Eaton, did you testify on this bill before?
I did not.
Why don't you come on up? It's only because we knew you drove an hour to get up here that we're going to let you talk today.
Thank you.
Tiffany, you want to tell us a little bit about the bill?
Refresh
our recollections.
We actually heard Senate Bill 164 on March 24th. It's back before us again for further consideration. Essentially, what the bill would do is it would require people who are being paid to gather signatures on state initiative or referendum petitions to register and complete a training program. It would also prohibit petitioners from using cover sheets or signature pages that lack the secretary's official template, and it would also prohibit someone other than the person actually signing the petition from altering the personal information contained in on one of the signature pages on a petition.
Okay. Ms. Eaton.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Kathy Eaton. I'm the governance chair for the League of Women Voters of Oregon. Our one comment from the League is that this is an important bill. The one area in which we find fraud in our election system is in the passing of petitions, particularly those by paid petitioners. We believe that this that Senate Bill 164 is an effort to close that gap in dealing with fraudulent passing of petitions and changing them so that they may be against the will of the person who has signed it.
Thank you.
That's really all I want.
Okay. Ms. Eaton, I just, as I'm kind of going through the measure summary and the bill, and I anticipate that this bill has a lot of hurdles to overcome in terms of getting through this process, could you tell me what you think is the most important pieces of the bill?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think both sections 2 and 4, particularly I believe Section 2 is where it deals with changing what people who are signing the petition, changing perhaps the date that they have used or filling in where they have not filled in. And the indications from the Secretary of State's office are that there are instances where incorrect information, fraudulent information has been put in there. There have been signature signing parties, if you will, from people who are being paid to gather signatures. This would close that loophole. Also, Section 4, which speaks to the registration and training of paid petitioners so that there is a knowledge on the part of the people who are, in fact, earning money to put petitions on the ballot have an opportunity to know how they should be acting in that capacity, and that there are rules and regulations that they must follow. I believe, Senator Brown, that at the first hearing, there was a concern brought by the disabled community and I think you were going to have perhaps some short amendments, but we wanted to be on the record as supporting those so that there could be assistance for people who had difficulty signing those petitions, because we certainly don't want to prohibit or make it more difficult for them to do that.
Okay. Great. Thank you. Any questions for Ms. Eaton? Senator Shields, go ahead.
I'm looking at some testimony that I haven't seen before that I guess came to our desk today from Dan Meek.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I don't imagine you've seen it, but I just want to read a little bit of it. He says on the second page of his testimony that the organizers of petition campaigns now typically pre-validate voter signatures by going to the county elections office and looking at each signator's voter registration information, including signature. In this process, petitioners can make notes on the signature sheet to the county officials, who will later be validating the signatures. For example, if both the signature and the printed name of the individual are not legible, the petitioner can take the time, which election officials do not take, to look up the voter by address and then in small letters print legibly the voter's name on whatever space is left in the printed name quote. He's essentially saying under 164 we won't be able to do that. You think that's a major issue, a major problem?
I don't know, and I would defer to John Lundback from the Director of Elections, who is here, who might be able to, because of his relationship to the county clerks, to know a little bit more about that piece. But from what experience I have, I would not think that petitioners are going to go to elections offices and do that.
Okay. Mr. Lindbeck, do you want to come on up?
Maybe the statement itself was an overstatement. I don't know. That's why I was reading.
It was Senator Brown, Senator Shields. I would think that.
Or did you hear what I was reading?
Do you have a copy of the Meek letter?
I do not have a copy of the Meek letter. I'm sorry.
Okay.
Madam Chair, I'm John Lindbeck, Director of Elections in the Secretary of State's office. I haven't seen the Meek letter.
Okay.
The paragraph I read was on page 2, right in the middle of the page, talking about organizers, further organizers of petitioning campaigns, typically. Go ahead.
Right. The idea here is that we do not, it is confusing to people at various steps in the process when you see handwriting from a bunch of different people on a petition sheet. We don't know who did it and when and why and what the motivations are. There's nothing that would stop chief petitioners from writing on a separate piece of paper that this illegible name on line 3 of petition sheet 256 is really Sam Adams. They don't have to, in order to do that, they don't have to write right on the sheet. And so I think that we can pass a bill like this and solve the problem of all this extraneous material on petition sheets, and that they can still do what they want to do, which is try to be helpful to the county elections worker in the process by just simply putting it on a separate piece of paper.
So, Mr. Lindbeck, would the county elections clerk then consider that a valid signature if there's notations elsewhere on the sheet?
You know what? Under election law, it is the clerk's decision. That is their call, and they will look at extraneous information and make a judgment as to whether or not they think they've got a separate piece of paper that says this is Sam Adams' signature, and whether or not they can take a look at the petition and tell for sure. And under state law, that's their authority and their call.
And there are times when pick on Senator Brown. You look at a signature and I have no idea whose that is, but somebody says, oh, that's Senator Brown's signature, and I look at it a minute and say, oh yeah, because once you know, you see it.
Right, but I also am aware enough that when I sign my signature on a petition, I also am aware that on the printed piece, I have to write it in a way that it becomes legible. So, okay. So, Mr. Lindbeck, I think it would be appropriate for you to take Mr. Meek's letter. I guess we're kind of short what we need to pass this bill out today, and I guess I sort of see the kernels of this bill as twofold. Number one, the training piece, mm-hmm. and number two, the prohibition on altering a line. So I don't know where folks are. I have sort of strong body language from one of the senators that it doesn't matter what we do, but that no, neither of those concerns will, you know, we can address those concerns. I can't tell from the other body language, but I guess my suggestion would be is that you put together a very small work group very quickly to try and address some of these concerns.
In this line.
Yes, around those. Yes, we can. Ms. Harris suggested that we can tell all the citizens to print legibly on all the petition sheets, but yeah, right. Mm-hmm. Anyway, I'm happy to participate and happy to have committee administrator help you do this, but I think we need to really narrow down what the Secretary of State's office feels is the most important and try and move one or both of the provisions.
Could I comment a moment?
Sure.
Senator Brown, thank you. I think that this could be an integral part of the training for the petition passers to make sure that when they're passing their petitions, they suggest to the person who's signing that they sign it the way they would, but certainly print it very legibly. And that could certainly be part of you know, the spiel that you get.
The Meek memo raises some constitutional issues with the requirement of training, and I don't know, Mr. Lindbeck, if you know off the top of your head whether those have merit or don't, but Ms. Harris, do you want to go ahead? That's it.
Well, for the record, I haven't had a chance to read this in its entirety, but I do think that courts draw a distinction between the state's ability to regulate things like fraud and advance those interests versus interfering with a citizen's right to actually cast a vote. And because I think that the signature signing process is fundamentally different from the process that you use, not fundamentally different, but different in some ways from the process involved in casting a ballot, I think as long as the state can articulate an important interest or fraud concern, then the law would probably be upheld.
Okay.
That's sort of the concept that courts would weigh as they looked at something like this.
Mr. Lindbeck?
If I could add, we have a serious, I pointed to this the last time this bill was up, we do have a serious problem with fraud in this process. Just a little update for you. The most recent cases that have crossed my desk involve two confessions from people that are pretty young that were hired to pass petitions, one of whom forged signatures from a group home of voters who live in a group home for the disabled in Albany. And as time goes on, we're building this fraud case, and it gets stronger and stronger and stronger, and it is undeniable that we have a fraud problem in this process, and we are just going to keep talking about it and keep asking to do something about it until the legislature passes this legislation that we think we need.
Okay. I'd be curious to hear what Mr. Meek and other of the folks opposing this legislation want to do in terms of the fraud issue. I mean, if they're opposing this legislation, then I'd like to see them come up with some other proposals that would address the fraud issue, because I am very committed to addressing the fraud issue. I think the registration training piece gets you there. I just think in terms of how it's written, some of the details need to be ironed out.
I think it's a serious issue. I really do.
The other person that we might want to talk to is either Mr. Marbet or Mr. Kafouri and Mr. McDougall in terms of this issue, to see if we can get some language from them that might be less less concern. So,
more user-friendly?
Yes. Ms. Harris?
Sure. One final brief comment. I think the other thing that courts have said in this type of situation is that as long as the law is narrowly tailored to address the particular concerns, the legitimate concerns of fraud, then the laws are usually presumed valid. So I think in terms of working the bill in the future, the key is really to make sure that the law is as narrowly tailored as possible to target the specific fraud concerns without impinging upon the citizen's rights to be actively engaged in the ballot process.
Okay, very good. Sarah Atkinson, any thoughts? Okay. Thank you. I think at that point we'll close the public hearing and work session on SB 164. Anything further to come before the for the committee? For tomorrow? Okay. We'll do that tomorrow. So that's it for tomorrow?
No, we have a...
Okay. All right. Okay. On that happy note, we're adjourned for the day.